What are the opportunities for biotechs on the Chinese market? Get answers to this question in the podcast episode with the PFC Group. In this episode, we talk about the PFC Group, the capital market landscape in China, deal structuring, clinical strategies for and why affordability and accessibility of new drugs matter the most in China.
I mean, Christian, that's a great point you bring up, because one of the things that we realized at KBP when I had a team in China and a team in the US.
For about BFC Group, we are a leading healthcare investment bank in China. Also have footprints all over the world, including US, UK, Korea, and Japan, and India. We closed more than 100 deals with over $8 billion in total deal value.
You know, China is now the second largest pharma market in the world, with Japan being third.
Yeah, in the past few years, like most of our BFC clients coming to China are still in clinical phase one.
But there's a flip side of the coin, which is that the China market really rewards innovation in antibiotic research.
Possibility, there's a growing middle class in China that, you know, that are looking for changes, the quality of life.
So at the end of the day, it's like any group you're trying to engage with, you want to get a personal connection. You want to educate and not sell, but really educate it. Looking at the first quarter of 2022, 18 new drugs were approved in China. 12 of them came from the West.
The speakers in this episode are Dr. Chia Enqin. She has more than 20 years of research and management experience at Dupont, the Upjohn Company, Pharmacia and Upjohn, Pharmacia, Lilly, and MPI Research, now CRL. Her R&D experience includes research leadership in asthma, rheumatoid arthritis, cardiovascular, and neurodegeneration. Dr. Jean's research has been published in over 35 peer-reviewed articles and book chapters. She has a PhD in chemistry from the University of South Carolina and postdoctoral research at Indiana University. Tis Bohr is venture partner at the BFC Group in the United States. Tis has worked 25 years in biotech in over 10 countries, from startup stage through to IPOs on Wall Street. In addition to multiple board roles, he has held senior executive and CEO roles at KBP, Biosciences, GE Healthcare, Azure Rx, Biopharma, Fluoropharma, and Intelligent Material Solutions. As an analyst at Credit Suisse and JP Morgan, he covered the biotechnology and medical devices sectors. Pharmacy degree from the University of Toronto, graduate studies at McMaster University, and an MBA from Columbia Business School are his education. Shirley Liu is principal of the BFC Business Development and Leadership Team in leading and facilitating multiple licensing transactions, including Aravive, Leap, Centera. Prior to working at BFC, she had rich experience in professional services for Hong Kong, US, and China-listed companies at PricewaterhouseCoopers. Her roles included annual auditing, IPO, and senior notes issuance. She also engaged in market entry projects at AstraZeneca and cross-border M&A transactions in Sinolink Securities. She has an AICPA certificate, bachelor degree from Ohio State University, and an MBA from the China-Europe International Business School. The BFC Group is a China-based investment banking firm with a focus on healthcare, merger and acquisition, licensing, and financing. The group works with leading healthcare companies in the United States, Europe, and Asia. With a first-hand operational experience in both the United States and China, the group has a deep understanding of the challenges their clients face when establishing or expanding their company's presence outside of the home market. I hope you enjoy this episode the same way as I did. Thank you very much for today that we can talk about China and the great opportunities for life science entrepreneurs. Shirley Lu is today on the episode, Qian and Tis Spore from China and the United States. Let me start with a little bit of an introduction why I believe it's important to talk about the relations with China. It's basically from my past and my history. In my first impression I got about China was in the 70s. It was basically martial arts movies from China, which I loved watching like a boy. And the first real trip to China was in 2014. It was an invitation from the Chinese Shaolin Temple. They have a subsidiary here in Vienna. And it was a trip to the Henan province to train with the Shaolin monks. And with that picture in mind that they had from the 70s, with this medieval martial arts movies that dated somewhere in 1500, 1600, 1700, I traveled from Vienna to Berlin and then boarded a plane to Beijing. And I hope I spelled the city name right, but Chinese is inexistent. Then to the capital of the Henan province, I think it's Shangshu. And what was really astonishing for me was how modern the airports were. I mean, there was Berlin Tegel, it was the old airport, and then the modern airport in Beijing. It was felt like having a trip to the future. In 2017, I did the next trip to China. It was with Austrian politicians. We had a round trip in China. We first went to Hong Kong and then went also, I hope I spelled the name right, to Guangzhou in a few kilometers, I think, westwards in China, and then to Shanghai. And what impressed me back then in 2017 was that I thought in 2014 I have a trip to the future. But it was further in the future in 2017. There was such a huge difference in development in China. The development speed was so amazing that in only 3 years, the airports became bigger. The buildings were astonishing. I never saw such big skyscrapers. And on the trip, I also heard for the first time the big goal of China to become the innovation leader of the world. And this was the first time when I thought, it makes sense to build relations between Europe and China to work together, because we have great scientists here in Europe. And also if China intends to move further towards scientific innovation, basically in life science, maybe there are great touch points. And this is my background story, why I thought now in 2022, it's 5 years that I didn't see China. And I want to learn with your help what changed in China in the last 5 years, what's the direction in which China is going, and how can life science entrepreneurs from Europe and also from other parts of the world access the Chinese ecosystem in the best way. And I'm very happy that today we can talk with the BFC Group. And I would like to hand over to Qian for her introduction.
Yes, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be. I am Qian Chen. I am with the Business Development Group with BFC Group, although I am based in the U.S. So my history, my background, my education is I have a PhD in chemistry, and I've always done discovery research in big pharma for over 25 years, and I also spent some time in preclinical tox CRO. So my role at BFC Group in the US is really to work with my colleagues based in Shanghai and also our clients as they take their innovations outside of China into the rest of the world. So very good to be here.
Good to see you. Tis.
Yes, thanks for having me on the program, Christian. Good morning, good afternoon. So I'm a nuclear pharmacist by training. I worked for a company called Amersham, which is a global company. And my first exposure to Hong Kong and in the China market was fixing Hong Kong's first nuclear pharmacy and moving that forward. Fast forward, I went to Wall Street as a publishing analyst. And then I took several companies public, and including we made a reasonable attempt with a Chinese company called KBP Biosciences. I was formerly their CEO. And really was interesting having a team of 60 terrific people based in China and also a team in the US to really help a Chinese company become a global company. And I had a terrific time there, some great experiences. And so I'd love to share my thoughts on, you know, really what's interesting for Western companies into China and China companies into the West.
Thank you very much. Great expertise here in the room. I love that. Shirley, could you tell us a little bit more about you and the BFC Group?
Yeah, sure. Good morning, good evening. So my name is Shirley Lu. I'm based in Shanghai. My background is finance. So before BFC Group, I worked for PricewaterhouseCoopers as auditor. And also I had experience in AstraZeneca strategy team and also cross-border M&A transaction team in Sinolink Securities. Currently in BFC Group, I am in charge of the BD licensing business, including the cross-border licensing, joint venture, financing transactions. So this including the doing the in-licensing assets from the ex-China biotech companies and also out-licensing assets to global companies.
That's great. May I ask, before we start, jump on the presentation about the BFC Group, where you are located? So we have Shanghai today, and where are you in the United States?
So I'm normally based on the East Coast of the United States. So I'm a venture partner with BFC Group. But usually I'm anywhere where there's an airplane. So I could be anywhere in the world. It happens today, I'm in Indianapolis, but normally I'm on the East Coast of the US.
Indianapolis, isn't that the famous IndyCar racing center?
That's one of the many things that's famous here.
This is the only thing I guess I know about Indianapolis. And Chien, you are in value today.
I am based in the US, as I mentioned earlier, but in the middle of the country. So I am based in Michigan, about 100 miles west of Ann Arbor, so halfway between Detroit and Chicago. But I have lived in Indianapolis, where the Indy 500 car race is every year. Very exciting.
I think this is amazing because when I think back to 2014, such a video conference was not possible with connecting the United States, Europe, and Shanghai in one call with a crystal clear connection. It's so amazing how technology advanced in the last years.
Well, I mean, Christian, that's a great point you bring up, because one of the things that we realized at KBP when I had a team in China and a team in the US is that we were able to have these sort of face-to-face meetings. And even with the COVID shutdown, business as usual for our company, because we were able to keep going, interacting with our colleagues. We just got used to this kind of dynamic. So it's not a substitute for an in-person meeting, but not every meeting has to be in person. So again, the technology is amazing.
That's true. I couldn't agree more. Shadi, would you like to lead us through the BFC Group's history?
Yeah, sure. May I share my screen? So there's a couple of slides I prepared for you. Okay. So before we start our discussion about China market and the potential collaborations between China companies and the rest of the world and European companies, I would like to share some background information. First of all, about BFC Group, and secondly, the capital market landscape and BD transaction landscape in China. So first of all, about BFC Group, we are a leading healthcare investment bank in China. So as you probably already noticed that we headquartered in Shanghai, but we also have footprints all over the world, including US, UK, Korea, and Japan, and India. And we do the domestic and the cross-border transactions, but we only focus on the healthcare sector. The BFC is founded in 2011, and so far we've been closed more than 100 deals with over $8 billion in total deal value. And most of our team members are science background or coming from the industry background. And here are the three business we do. The first one is capital raising, second one is M&A, and third is BD licensing, as I mentioned, also both in licensing and out licensing. And here's our global presence. We have colleagues and partners all over the world. Also, we have conferences every year, twice every year. One is in Shanghai, the other one is in San Francisco. San Francisco one is during the JP Morgan week. So this is some pictures we had for the previous years. And next, about capital market landscape in China. So first of all, I want everyone to take a look at the US market. So here you can see the number of IPOs for biotech companies in the past few years. I mean, past 10 years, maybe. It's been climbing, slightly climbing every year, and it's peaked in 2021. There were 64 biotech companies IPOs in NASDAQ. But this year, because of the really bad macro environment, there are only 4 IPOs in the first half of 2022. And then let's take a look at the China market. So on the left-hand side, it is the Shanghai stock market. So background information about Shanghai stock market is that it's just opened in 2018. So the first IPO for Shanghai stock market is in 2019. And this stock market is only for the innovative companies. So here are the number of the IPOs for biotech companies. And you can see there are 15 and 12 in the past couple of years. And this year, in the first half of this year, there were 9 IPOs happening in stock market. And in right-hand side, it is Hong Kong market. This is also the IPO numbers for the biotech companies. And this first half of this year, there were 3 IPOs for biotech companies. So on this page, it will be more clear for audience to compare the two markets, the NASDAQ market and the China market. So on the left-hand side, we can see the number of the IPOs for biotech companies. The China IPOs are less than 50% of the US market. But on this year, for the first half of this year, China has outperformed than the NASDAQ market. NASDAQ were 4 and China was 12. And on the right-hand side, it is total proceeds raised at IPOs. Even the number didn't catch up the US market, but we can see that in 2020 and 2021, the total proceeds raised at IPO is almost the same as the US market for the China market. And for the this year, the first half of this year, it's even 5 times over US market. So there's not too much we can complain about the secondary capital market in China. And then let's take a look at the primary market. So here on the left-hand side is the total number of the financing events happening in China for the healthcare sector. So after COVID-19, there are more investors and either individual investors or the institutional investors, they started to more focusing on the healthcare sector. So we can see the events increased a lot in 2021. And this year, the first half of this year, even we have lockdowns in Shanghai and many other cities for 3 months, the events still reached to almost 1,000 financing events for only half of this year. And if we break it down by sectors, we can see 1/3 of the financing events coming from pharmaceutical sector, and 1/3 is coming from medical devices, and 1/3 is coming from the services, and the rest of them are CROs or CDMOs. And it's in terms of the rounds, it's starting from the angel to all the way to the B round. And now let's look deeper into the pharmaceutical sector. So it's basically consistent with the overall healthcare sector. It's increased a lot in 2021, but still continues a trend in this first half of this year. In terms of the modality, we can see most of the biotech companies are focusing on small molecule, followed by cell therapy and gene therapy, and also antibody drugs. Yeah, so the capital market is pretty good here in China. It's catching up the U.S. market. And in this year, with this very terrible macro environment, the global capital market is really bad, but China is still performing very well. So, yeah, again, we can't not complain about the capital market here in China. And next, I want to share some overview about BD transactions in China. So the first graph we can see is a China-related BD transactions. It's slightly increasing every year. But this year, if we annualize the first half, the deals of the first half of this year, it's still decreased almost 50%. But it's consistent with the global deals. So for the global, this is not a very good year to do a lot of transactions.
Do you enjoy this episode? Then please like, follow, and share.
And in terms of the deal type, you can see most of the China-related transactions are licensing deals, followed by joint venture or M&A transactions. And now let's take a look at the in-licensing deals. So in the past 5-6 years, it's been increasing every year. But this year, the number of the in-licensing deals has been dropped by 50% at least. But if we look at the percentage of the partner companies in this in-licensing deals, which means the licensee is a China company and the licensor is a company outside China. So the cross-border percentage is around 70%. So during this environment, the China companies, they are still looking for more assets from outside China rather than in China. So the trend is still continues from to looking assets outside China. So there are still a lot of opportunities for US company or European companies to find a partnership here in China. And this next one is about out-licensing. So I would say the 2020 is a starting point of China going to the global. So this year, there are 40 companies successfully out-license their asset to the global market. And this trend continues. And even though the total out-licensing deals decreased, but we can see here in the green one, the 21 deals in the first half of this year is a cross-border out-licensing deal, which means the China innovative drugs enter into the global market. So if we annualize it, it will be 42 for this year. So the trend continues for out-licensing. So that's pretty much on the overview I shared with our audience. And definitely we do have more detailed analysis and more detailed breakdowns and more detailed like top transactions happening in the recent years. But given the limited time we have, I only share this much today, but I am happy to share more details if our audience would like to know more. You can feel free to contact us.
We can also have a second podcast recording focusing on innovation in China that reaches the global market. Let me ask you some questions to the presentation. When I look at China as a whole, so the big question, or the first question that comes to my mind is, which opportunities do you see for biotechs in China to take their innovations to the Chinese market?
Yeah, definitely. There's I would say there's a lot of opportunities for innovative companies to biotech companies to enter into China. As I mentioned, that China companies are still very actively looking for the innovative drugs from outside China compared to the domestic innovative drugs. Although the innovation is catching up in China, but you know, the US market and the European market, there are really good, amazing drugs that we can meet the unmet medical needs here in China. So they are still very popular.
So, I mean,
and
one of the things
that the company to come to China. Sorry,
yeah, so, yeah, no. So, Christian, one of the things that I think is really important to look at is the pace of innovation and where it's going. So it's not just where is the market on the demand side for the dollar spent for patients. It's also on where is the dollar spent as relates to R&D work and where things are going. You know, in terms of market size and scale, you know, China is now the second largest pharma market in the world, with Japan being third. But if you go into where the innovation is being driven, the U.S. right now accounts for about 50% of all sort of clinical trial and research spend. China's number two at about 14%, and then Japan and Korea about 5% each. So there's a lot of innovation coming up from China. I think we're starting to see some products come to the market that were novel made in Asia therapies. And I'm thinking of things like Brukinsa and Carvykti. And so these are our made in China or innovated in China therapies coming to the global stage. So I think with like any market, you're going to get two-way exchange of ideas, products, talent. And really it's a great chance and opportunity for Western technologies to go to China and for Western companies to look at bringing Chinese innovative tech into the West.
Let me ask you one question. When I look towards bringing innovation to China, in 2017 and also in 2018, I had the feeling that Chinese companies mostly look for drugs and devices that are already on the market in Europe or in the United States or somewhere else in the world. Whereas when I look at the deals here in Europe and the United States, very often pharma companies also start negotiating licensing deals or joint research collaborations with early stage companies and with research organizations. How is the appetite of Chinese pharma companies these days? Are they still more focused on already approved drugs, or are they intending also to go a little bit earlier?
So, I mean, I'll comment on the on our clients that I've interacted with, and our clients are really looking across the spectrum. It's obviously lower risk to take something that's ready to go straight to patients, though the price is always higher. But a lot of our clients are realizing now that they want to see early ideas. And just like a Western company, they're not going to do a deal on every early asset, but there's some really good ones that can find value. And I think it's been a huge shift between 2015, when I was looking at doing licensing deal into China, the Western technology, where they really wanted to close to commercialization. So now, as we're looking with our clients, at least in with the BFC group, there's a lot of interest up and down the innovation spectrum. So like anywhere, the more data you have, the more compelling the story is, the higher the price will be, but the lower the risk. And so it's always a game that every executive plays at every pharma company, Chinese, Western, doesn't matter where.
And to Tae's point, so if you take a look at of the most the highest number of the payment, I mean in terms of the total deal size and upfront payment happening in the past couple of years, you can see most of them are the clinical stage asset rather than market asset. So the China biotech companies, they are becoming more professional, and the science team can really understand the data and also the MOAs of these innovative drugs. So they are looking for the assets in the clinical stage. And nowadays, it's becoming very competitive for the between the biotech companies and pharmaceutical companies. If you started to look at assets very late, I mean, if you see you do not want to take any risk, then you will get nothing, because all the good assets already take over when it's still in clinical stage. So if you, I mean, for the market asset, you will not get a chance to get it now, because China companies are already getting it when it's still at early stage.
Yeah, this is this changes a lot, in my opinion, for the strategies of the company so far. When I was asked for advice how to set up the out-licensing strategy of companies here in Europe, I recommend it. Look first towards Europe. Then when you need more capital and wants to out-license early, go to the United States because there is an appetite there. And when you look towards China, focus more on drugs that are already on the market because this is the core focus of Chinese pharma companies. And when I understood you right now, this changed completely. So that China is now also going early stage, and it makes sense for life science companies that are not yet on the market already to start taking up talks with Chinese pharma companies. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. It really comes down to making sure you have a good data package. But that being said, innovation is innovation. Humans are everywhere, and these markets are massive. And so, deals that I looked at in 2017 were really heavily back-end loaded, no upfront payments, and really sort of, a lot of work without a lot of return. Now, BFC clients are actually getting significant upfront milestones in certain cases if their technology is very compelling.
Yeah, in the past few years, like most of our BFC clients coming to China are still in clinical phase one stage. And so there are a lot of people looking at the asset and also received a lot of term sheets on this phase one clinical asset. Yeah, so it is changing compared to the 2017.
Phase one already. That's really early.
Yeah, phase one. Phase two. Sometimes, definitely people are asking for POC data, right? They want to direct the asset. But some biotech companies, they have the scientists coming back from the United States, and they've been working for MNCs and also very cutting-edge companies previously. So they understand the technology and they can take some risk.
This takes me to the next question that I think is also key to success when starting negotiating with companies. It's obviously the question, what's the focus in terms of therapeutic areas of Chinese companies these days, especially in the next 5 years, Tis and Shirley?
Sure. I'll start with things that are not appealing, and it's a really interesting way to think about it. In the U.S. right now, if you start a company looking at rare disease, you get a lot of support. There's big vouchers. There's big bonuses, incentives. But the Chinese philosophy, as far as we see it, towards innovation isn't really an expensive therapy that only helps a few people. China is looking at their payment reimbursement system and how do they treat the population as a whole. So there's a lot of interest in things where there's broad patient access and a lot of therapies. The rare diseases are trickier. I think that you can do some rare disease work on your clinical trial work, but there's a market where you can get a priority review voucher, one of these other orphan drug designations. That's not as straightforward or as much of an incentive to do work into China. I think as you look at unmet medical need, they're always there. We see them across every disease state. There's always room for innovation. And the big markets where you can treat a lot of people with meaningful benefits really get rewarded in China. The ones that don't as much is really on the rare disease side. But there's a flip side of the coin, which is that the China market really rewards innovation in antibiotic research. So I think in the West, with the recent global pandemics, there's been more of an interest in bio research. There isn't a lot of innovation on the antifungal side. Mm-hmm. But in China, there's a huge push on the antibacterial side. So Chinese payers, hospitals, physicians are willing to reward innovation for advances in antimicrobial therapy. And that's a very interesting therapeutic area for Chinese companies to license in. If you're trying to bring an antibiotic, an antibacterial to the US market, it's very, very tough on the capital markets and reimbursement side.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, my first company in the life science industry was a spin-out from Novartis. It was Nabreva. The department was built by Rutger Novak, who now runs CRISPR Therapeutics. And it was in the antibiotic space. The plans that we had in 2006 were great, but I think in the last 10 years, they changed a lot in Europe and the United States. It's not the most attractive market. I think the only company here in Europe that's doing something in that area is currently BioNTech, who starts not only doing antiviral research, but also antibacterial research. How is the situation? How many companies are active in China in that area? What are the front runners in that area?
Yeah, I would say cancer is always a hot area, no matter the previous, whether the previous or the trend in the future. I didn't share the slide about a breakdown of the in licensing in terms of the therapeutic area, but if I share that slide, you will see that cancer is always the number one every single year, the in licensing and also the out licensing. I mean, the biotech companies, they understand about cancer, and also they understand about the unmet medical needs here in China, and standard of care and the reimbursement is good here for cancer. So cancer is always a hot topic. And as Tae mentioned, anti-infections, I would say that would be a second hottest area. The antibiotics, although there are some restrictions in the hospital, if you enter into one antibiotics drug, you have to kick out another one. But as long as you prove it's superior than the current ones, or it's first in class, better in class, or solve some unmet medical needs, you will get opportunities here.
Christian, I mean, that's completely different than the U.S. perspective. When I did, key opinion leader research with infectious disease physicians, I say, I have a new drug here, it's better, superior. They say, wonderful. We will never use it. We'll save it just in case. And so you can have the most amazing antibacterial ever. Everyone will think you're absolutely wonderful, but they won't buy a single dose. So you get zero rewards for innovation. Whereas in China, it's the opposite. Yes, something has to go that doesn't work, but they will definitely reward innovation in the antibacterial space.
That's good to know. What are the major players in cancer and antibacterials on the Chinese market?
For the antibiotics, I would say a lot of traditional pharmaceuticals, they are in this area. You know, there is a lot of antibiotics, there are generics, right? So a lot of traditional pharmaceuticals, they are very good at commercialization. Mm-hmm. And they started a company by commercialized drugs. So those traditional pharmaceuticals, they know how to sell this antibiotics. And they have this network and sales force with the hospitals. In terms of cancer, I would say biotech companies, they will be more interested in the cancer, such as Zai Labs, Beijing, Everest. You probably see those names in the past few years when they do the in-licensing deals. So traditional pharmaceuticals like Qilu, Yangtze River, they started to catching up and they did some deals as well. So traditional pharmaceuticals, they trying to transform to the innovative company as well. So there's a lot of opportunities.
So I'd like to, jump in right here. Also, we haven't touched on the huge market potential in China for chronic diseases. Mm-hmm. Underscoring Shirley's point that cancer is king at this point, but with the aging population worldwide, not just in China, companies and governments are looking for innovative new therapies, neurodegeneration, heart disease, diabetes, just to name a few, neuropathy, pain. These are really rich areas for innovative companies outside of China and within and domestically to really target if they have good ideas, if they have good technology, to really not neglect China. And many companies we see now that are outside of China have a two-pronged approach. They have a Western strategy, be it European or the US, and simultaneously in tandem in China as well. So it's not as an afterthought, but really part of the strategy moving forward in terms of monetizing their innovation globally, truly globally, not just regional. A lot of companies traditionally think of the US and Europe as global, but I think we really need to educate the whole sector that global should really mean global and take into account other regions that have, not been the focus for many biotechs for whatever reason. So just
I think about my old company as a great poster child of that, where KBP Biosciences, interesting private company based in Jinan, China and the US. They have a phase 3 asset for hypertension, a small molecule in patients with chronic kidney disease. At the same time, also novel antibacterial with both IV and oral formulations, right? And so again, these are things that really resonate with Chinese markets, consumers, large patient bases, innovation desperately needed. And ultimately, this is really the goal for China innovation. It's not usually it used to be very much a me too kind of products. And now there's a big push for me first or me better. And I think that's really been a shift in how R&D heads think about their pipeline.
Great points. Excellent points. Let's say a little bit about the, go-to-market in China strategy. I remember, and other points that are also important when we think about that, I remember conversations from 14, 15 years ago. There's always the question when we take a small molecule or other innovation out of the research organizations, where should we seek a patent protection? And the usual conversation back in 2006, 7, and 8 was, we seek protection in Europe and usually the major market. It's the United Kingdom, it's Germany, it's France, it's I think also a little bit of Spain and Italy, the United States. And then when I raised the question, say, what about China? The usual answer I got was, we don't file anything in China because at the end of the day, we are focusing on developing for the core markets, for Europe and for the United States. And we don't understand China anyways. And the chance of selling or licensing something to Chinese companies is very, very little. So we don't file it. Is that still a good strategy, or was the strategy ever a good strategy?
Oh my gosh. Without naming and shaming people too much, that was the common strategy that people had, especially tech transfer offices at universities and people looking to save a few thousand dollars on patent filing costs. That's probably the most expensive mistake they ever could have made in their career. And if you're going to do a deal in China right now, you must have your IP. Clinical data won't suffice. You have to have IP there as well. It's not that hard to do. There's extraordinary harmonization for intellectual property guidelines and also for clinical trial guidelines with China being a member of the ICH. So the best thing for any innovator to do is protect the rights in China, because the intellectual property is honored, it's enforced, and it's worth a lot of money.
What's the consequence if a company doesn't do that?
Yeah, I would say if a company doesn't have IP protection here in China, it's almost a dead for the partnering in China. China partners, potential partners, if we outreach to them for asset, the first couple of questions they will ask is, what is expiry date of the composition of matters in China? If we tell them there's no composition of matters here in China, oh no, we're not going to take a look at this asset. So this is very important. So if I haven't filed IP in China, better to do it as soon as possible. So this, as Tay said, it will be the most expensive cost in your career.
Is it possible to repair that later down the road? I think there's a couple of years time to file for patent protection. And when the time is passed, then there is no chance anymore. Do you see any possibilities for companies that didn't seek protection in China that they can repair that?
So it's none of us are patent attorneys on the call here, so we don't want to give advice. But I think the advice is talk to a patent attorney, right? Because every story is different. If there's a method or a process or dosage, there are some other patents that you can start to work with. But really, the core thing that most people should be thinking about is composition of matter. Once you have that, then you can look at a more extensive blocking strategies. And same thing in China as everywhere else.
That's great. What other points do you think are important? Is important for companies who would like to bring innovation to Chinese markets?
There's an awful lot. So I think let's break that question into two pieces. So I think, I'll start with the regulatory things that I've seen. And it's so important to have a good local Chinese partner on the regulatory side. And so in the Western markets, we're used to being slight changes in the approval process and the requirements for getting a drug approved, phase 1, phase 2, phase 3. China really revamps things so frequently in terms of the rules, in terms of if it's only Chinese data, when you have to have Chinese data, when you do something called a bridging study, which means you sort of look at a genetic group of patients who are not Chinese and the patients who are genetically Chinese, and sort of demonstrate that there is bioequivalency or comparability. So it's really, you know, as you're thinking about your drug development pathway, you really want to think about where you do your trial work. At the end of the day, you're going to do your work, you're going to get good quality data. But if you're going to go into China for a commercial market or clinical trial market, you'll need to have done that bridging studies. There are some smarter jurisdictions where you can get ethnically Chinese patients or ethnically Asian patients. But at the end of the day, it's worth working with a good Chinese CRO to actually go and do it the normal way, meaning get the approval, submit your data, show that it's safe in animals, if you have any human data as well, but really get a Chinese regulatory expert. Because at this point, what you're seeing, you know, with only Chinese data going to the US or only US data going to China, it doesn't work anymore. And it's not that it's not trusted. There's a lot of push to make sure that there are, you're addressing the genetic composition of the patient population where you're trying to get approval. And you're seeing that a big push from the FDA. I haven't seen as much in Europe, but you're definitely seeing it in China too. So step one is really think about where you do those studies and spend the money to do it high quality. And so it doesn't, if you do a poor quality study in the US, it's not valid anywhere in the world. If you do a poor quality study in China, it's not really valid anywhere in the world, even in China. High quality studies will always win with high quality data.
Yeah, another very important considerations, I think a lot of our clients first come to us, didn't think about that, is the cost of goods sold. So, you know, especially for the antibodies, the cost of goods sold in the US and the European countries is not very big issue or problem because of the pricing can cover its cost. So, but in China, the pricing is a huge difference between huge difference from the US and European countries. So whether the China pricing can cover the cost of goods in the US or in the Europe is a big question. Most of the times, the China biotech companies, they may ask for whether we can do a tech transfer, whether we can localize the manufacturing, and we have to assess what is the cost of goods here in China. If it's low enough and we can compete with other competitive drugs. If it's really high and, you know, the sales and the marketing costs are already very high, if the cost of goods sold is still high, we cannot get this drug. There's no profit for the company anymore. So companies may think about the cost of goods sold when considering to work with a China company or enter into China market.
So, I mean, Christian, there's a real dynamic here that I think it's important for the listeners to think about, which is that in the US, especially, if you get a drug approved and reimbursed, every year after that, you work pretty hard to take price increases, and they tend to go through. In China, it's the other way around. Every, you know, you get your drug approved and reimbursed, there's a lot of pressure every year for price decreases. And so the expectation is that prices will go down. So you need to really understand your margins and really understand what you'll do at scale, recognizing that you can get huge volumes of your drug through. What does that mean for your profitability?
Yeah, so when the drug is listed in the reimbursement, national reimbursement list, the price normally will cut 50%. And then after you list it in the reimbursement list, and there will be a volume-based procurement. Mm. And if you enter into a volume-based procurement list, then the price will even cut. Maybe sometimes it may cut 80% or even more. But I mean, let's be conservative. Let's cut 50%. Then it's already like 75% cutting there. So pricing is not very friendly. So we have to take a look at the costs very closely.
But what is the thinking behind the pricing? Is the approach to make medicine affordable for everybody?
Yeah.
The difference in the United States?
Yeah, it's trying to make the patients affordable for this innovative drugs, also generic drugs.
I think there's another word that comes in as well, not just affordability, but accessibility.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really, the goal is really making sure that patients can have access, not to everything, but really the regulators take an active approach, what's in the formulary, what isn't. So you do get some of that, for example, in US hospitals, where you get, you know, a big push for formularies, but not really system-wide. Whereas in China, it's very much accessibility and affordability. So it's not like you have to sell below cost. You really need to really make sure that you're doing things in a very thoughtful fashion.
But then basically, it's you enter a 1.4 billion people market, theoretically. So it's...
Yeah.
Right. So just to add a little bit to, you know, the thoughts on when you set up your clinical trial, the data from Western companies, or, you know, outside of China, taking it in. I think there's a lot of push now, not just for cancer, but in other diseases, particularly in chronic diseases, about the use of biomarkers. So if you have data quality outside of China, using biomarkers to really, you know, demonstrate that your drugs, your technology, your innovation is really going to affect and, you know, really bring good data in China, you can really design your trials, not just the bridging, but really to target the market and target the segment and to really demonstrate the utility of your technology. And also, I think, you know, to the point where you want to, you know, think about price. I think it's not just price, but like taste it, accessibility. There's a growing middle class in China that, you know, that are looking for changes, the quality of life, not, you know, not just the shall we say, getting through the day, but really the quality of life is really first and foremost on a lot of, you know, patients' minds. And that's what we want to bring too, is, you know, alleviation of pain and suffering and quality of life to as big a, you know, segment as possible for the best price, obviously.
That's a great approach. I like it. Can we stay, you mentioned before clinical strategy. Can we stay a little bit or expand on that topic a little bit before we dive into other ones? When I think about financing life science projects, I mean, I think everybody knows that they are pretty costly to bring it to the market. And for a finance guy, I think the ideal perspective on data would be that we do preclinical trials in Europe. We do clinical trials once in Europe, phase one, phase two, and phase three. And then the data gets accepted in all regions and similarly in China, so that also Europe accepts the data and in the United States. How is the situation currently when we look at clinical trials? Is the data accepted? Do companies need bridging studies? Do companies need doing the same study in China and in Europe and the United States? What's your expertise in that area?
So my experience with having just gone through these negotiations with the various regulators is that you have to have bridging studies. And so it doesn't really matter, even if your target is a bacteria, right? You still need to have a bridging study in humans to see how does the drug work in a human. And so it's so important to have that, that bridging study sort of queued up. You can do the bridging study in a way that is either very inexpensive, so you do very quick sort of bioavailability, or you can do slightly broader, which is actually getting sort of efficacy data as well. And I think anytime you're spending the energy and time to get data from patients, get as much data as you can, because always, if you answer questions earlier, it's cheaper than answering them later, right, in much larger patient groups. And so I think the bridging studies are important. It's also important to do multicultural enrollment and multi-country enrollment. You know, not necessarily phase two that adds complexity, but, you know, going into phase three, the more countries you have, the better. And even just to run parallel programs for a drug. For example, if you have two different indications of the same drug, do one phase two in China, do one in the West, and then combine to have the safety exposure data for both ethnically Chinese patients for the China market and as well as Western patients. And so there are some, you know, thoughtful ways to, you know, to get sort of a two for one kind of deal.
Yeah, I agree with Tae. So bridging trial is based on the cases I've seen, that most of almost all the cases you have to do the bridging trials. And sometimes the China FDA, they may ask for, they will absolutely take a look at of the data outside China. They will take it as a reference. It's better if you already have a few China patients when you recruit it outside China. So that is a plus. But sometimes, even though you not only the clinical data, you also have to take a look at the preclinical data. I have a client that they aim to enter into the phase three directly in China, but they didn't even get an IND in China because China's FDA asked them to redo or conduct more preclinical studies. So the regulatory is very different. And in China, the IND is, I would say, it's sometimes it's even more restricted than the US. So if the company wants to enter into China, better to consult the CRO or study to start the partnering process as early as possible with China companies, even though you do not complete a deal immediately, but at least you will get a lot of feedback from China pharmaceutical companies. So those are valuable. You do not want to wait till the end that FDA, China FDA telling you that you have to conduct more preclinical trials while you are still considering to go to the phase three directly. So that's a huge gap there.
That's true. Is it possible to multi-center studies? So, for example, if phase one to include sites in China and Europe or in the United States, and also phase two and phase three, is that feasible, or doesn't it make any sense in your opinion?
It's tricky. Totally.
It's very smart, but it's tricky to do. So you have to really do the work behind it, because it's really a matter of timing. And so if one country is slow, you may be done everything in time. And so that's why you always have to think through with your regulatory affairs team, what's the smartest way to go for ramp up time. But I mean, obviously the more sites you do, but I think the other caveat there is that every country and every site adds more cost. And usually if your only business is phase one programs, you're really watching your cash carefully. So again, it's trade-offs everywhere.
So this is actually another reason why there's many biotech companies come to us. They want to enter into China at a very early stage. So let's say they started a partnering process when they're still in clinical phase one stage, and they close a deal with a China partner when they are in phase two. Then between the a deal close time to the start of the phase three, China partner have the time to file the IND and conduct some bridging trials for the phase one. And then China companies can directly join the MRCT globally. So it will be beneficial for both China partner and the biotech companies outside China. So it will save costs, and also it will accelerate the launch year in China. So that is a smart way, and that's why a lot of companies enter into China earlier, starting from phase one. That's a lot of case we see, and that's the clinical development plan come up by the China partners. They want to enter into a multi-regional clinical trial.
Yes, to add to that, I think that's a really important consideration. Of course, cost. As you know, small biotechs, that you really need to watch the cash flow. But really, to Shirley's point, when you think about going to China, your partner and who you work with needs to be carefully considered. Because you really want to add to the valuation, add to the value of your asset, and overall, as you mature. I think one of the things that I've heard from companies considering going to China is that they're so confused by, they go to a partnering meeting and they meet with 20 potential, partners, and they can't figure out who is whom and what is what. And I've also had companies that tell me that they would be, that they have considered, engaging with a company like ours, and they would have, these consulting companies tell them, it's great, we'll get it to work out. Where else they have not really heard what are the pitfalls, and not every strategy is, you know, perfect. It needs to be tweaked and you need to find the right partner. And so that process at the very beginning needs to be really carefully considered so you don't go down a path that's going to cost you later on in terms of your development and do damage to your asset, you know, in the long run.
That's true. There's one question that pops up in my mind when you talk about partnering and finding the right partner in China. What about the cultural similarities and differences and communication styles? How important are they these days? What's your take on that?
John and Chase may have a lot of experience on that one.
Yeah, I'll go first. So at the end of the day, it's like any group you're trying to engage with, you want to get a personal connection. You want to educate and not sell, but really educate and talk to people about the data. But my own experience with some roadshows was very tricky, where I would start giving a presentation and I sort of pause for questions and no questions. So I keep going and go through the whole presentation. And then, you know, culturally, that's when people start asking questions afterwards. And I end up giving the whole presentation twice because then each question had already been addressed on the slide. So it's very difficult. I think face-to-face helps a lot more than trying to do it over Zoom. You know, many sort of Zoom presentations, there's no cameras on, and it's really tricky. So the personal interaction is so important, especially when you have the language barrier too. And so I think, yeah, it's like for any cultural awareness, being thoughtful about what's there, being really trying to be clear with your messaging. But the most important thing I've found with the Chinese is being consistent. And so you may be asked the same question several times. It's not due to lack of comprehension. It's they really want to understand that you're consistent with your messaging, your approach, your conclusions, whatever that is. And so I think it's like any cultural awareness, right? You really be thoughtful about the person you're engaging with, try and listen, really give them opportunities to speak.
Yeah, I think to speak to that, you know, as Shirley said, as Chase has already, you know, mentioned, I think it's important for smaller biotechs, or, you know, to really try to understand first their asset and what their ultimate goal is, and also really to do the homework and go to partnering, you know, listen to podcasts like yours, you know, try to educate. And I think from, you know, face-to-face is always great, but, you know, in terms of like partnering, you know, conferences and, but the important thing is to really try to find out what your potential partners are looking for and to really reiterate the point. And, you know, culturally, like Chase said, they may be reticent in trying to ask you a question. So maybe you need to take the proactive approach and ask for feedback. And then a lot of times that's when, you know, conversations really start. You ask for feedback and you keep, you know, reiterating your point and also to look at it from a different way. And also importantly, you know, most of the potential, all the, you know, potential partners in China, they all speak great English. You know, the language, at least spoken, may be the last frontier, so to speak. So it's important to speak, you know, not to use a lot of colloquialism that you and I might understand, but may, you know, you completely miss the point in a conversation. So that's always important. And, you know, it's like face-to-face, it's always great. And my role in the U.S. is really to bring that aspect to help educate. Whether they eventually work with us or not, whether they eventually, you know, go into China or not, the first step is to really learn about the process and whether that is right for them. Is that a right strategy for them? And is this the right time? But it's never too early to learn. It's never too early to get the information. You know, and knowledge is, you know, we're becoming one world, whether we like it or not, in many ways.
Yeah,
especially in healthcare.
Now it's great becoming a one world. I hope that continues also. It helps a lot. I mean, you mentioned English. When I traveled to China, I said, okay, English is not my mother tongue. And for Chinese people, it's the same. So we're on the same page. And then I had conversations in China. And I mean, their English was basically perfect. So it was like directly from Oxford or from Harvard. I was really impressed about the language skills. It was really great. Is that still the case that English is a good starting point for conversations in China?
I think sometimes you don't have a choice, right? So if you if you have a
learning Chinese, what's the other option? Would be the other option.
Yeah, I think you're finding more and more multilingual people graduating these days from universities, both Western students who are learning Mandarin and a lot of Mandarin speaking kids who are learning English. So it really feels like English is the universal language. I will say, though, one really important thing for Chinese companies looking to go to the West is make sure your documentation is in English and so it can be read. I think for Western companies going to China, there really isn't a need to translate your technical documents in English is fine. But it can also be really helpful, though, for parts of your business plan to be professionally translated in advance into Mandarin or Chinese, and your website too. It's actually not that hard to add a Mandarin option on your website. And if you're really targeting the China market, it creates a lot of goodwill because it lets people understand very quickly the high level concept.
Yep, I think, our job, key aspect of our job for companies going to China and, with Shirley's team, is to really have the information both in Chinese and in English. So it's available to whichever company in whatever language that they would prefer, for communication, for dissemination of the data in order to facilitate a potential partnership. That is a very key important. And for the team, your China team, so to speak, to be able to communicate with you, the ex-China company, hoping to go into China, be able to have a seamless connection with your potential clients in China and for your parent company outside of China. And, in this age of Zoom, there should be no barrier. There should be no barrier. Seamless communication both ways in both languages. I think that's something that came out that really got accelerated, with the pandemic, unfortunately. But that is one takeaway.
That's true. When I think that one of the other companies who listen to the podcast might consider working on a China, go to China strategy. What's your advice? Should they do it alone initially? So it's just like I did, taking a trip to China, going to conferences, or should they seek for a local partner first and then to the China access together?
I'm going to say this first. Going to China on your own and just trying to discover things is really fun, but completely unproductive. And so if you actually want to get work done, don't use that approach. If you just want to have a good time, go for it. It can be really, really enjoyable to discover. I think you can save an awful lot of time and energy with introductions. And it's so important to have good introductions set up. The one surprising thing that I've noticed about any trip to China that I've done over the past 12 years is that don't expect your full itinerary in advance. Meaning, you're used to saying, okay, well, each day, which city will I be in and what are the meetings and can I get them all done before I step on the plane? And that's really not the case. I think a lot of meetings are done fairly quickly, not quite last minute, but day of or day before, and things get solidified because people's calendars are very, very dynamic. So I think, I've gone on a limb, I've taken some risk and said, great, I'll go to China, even though I don't know any meetings are set up. And yet, if you work with a partner like BFC, for example, when you land, every day your calendar will be completely full because it's really, if they know for sure you're there, they'll set up meetings. They're not going to set them up until they know you're on the airplane.
Yeah. So, yeah, if you engage an advisor like BFC, we'll be your translator, be your tour guide. It will be very efficient if you come to China. Speaking about whether to go it alone, I would say most of our clients first come to us, they have already tried by themselves. And then when I ask them, who have you already communicated or had a conversation with China partners, they always tell me the same names: Zai Lab, Beijing, Everest, Qilu, Sino Farmer, and that's it. Every time I hear about the same name, because those companies, they are very internationalized. They will come out and outreach to a lot of biotech companies all over the world. But others, there's still many other good companies, biotech companies and traditional pharma companies. They are here. They have cash, but they're just not that internationalized. They are not doing PRs all over the world. They are more focusing on the China. So whether you have this access to these companies are very key questions. If you can find like 80% of these companies, just go it alone. That's totally fine. I'm sure you can do the deal by yourself. But if not, it's better to engage an advisor to help you to outreach to this network, because you cannot bet on Zai Lab Beijing, because they didn't do a single deal this year, although they are amazing in the past few years. But this year, they didn't do a single one yet. So and next is about experience, as Jan Tae said, whether you had experience to working with China companies, not only the language, but also the culture. You know, a lot of decisions are made top down in China, but all the BDers who you already contact with are from the bottom to the top. So it's very difficult. So if you engage an advisor such as BFC, can help you to outreach to the senior management, the decision pathway will be much quicker. And also the negotiation skill, that's the same all over the world. It's always good to have a middleman to help you to negotiate and close the gap there. So I think there's a couple of things you have to think about when you decide to go it alone or to engage an advisor.
That's good. That's a great point. I mean, we are talking about large scale transactions anyways, and I think that they just take time. We're talking about 1, 2, 3 years and not about small scale transactions. So it makes sense to have a larger footprint in China with a partner and then walk together through this phase. I just realized that we are already 70 minutes in this call, and there are so amazing points that I think we could easily expand on for another 1 or 2 hours to talk about. Let me ask you one final question at the end, because funding usually, and we mentioned it very often in this call, is one of the key success factors. How is the availability of private and public funds on the Chinese markets for companies who would like to pursue a go to China strategy?
So I'll comment this in my own experience when trying to sort of raise capital in China for a global company. And I was amazed at how much cash was available. Mm-hmm. And so there's a big appetite for investment. There's a lot of appetite from both investors and multinationals and companies. But the capital, it's not dumb money. It's really, really, you know, the money wants to go to work towards innovative ideas. So expect a fairly rigorous diligence process. The one thing that's a little different actually between a Chinese deal and a Western deal is that, you know, there's a big time delay between actually agreeing on the deal and funding. So I think Western, you know, hedge fund managers are used to, once they sign the deal, they know the price, they're usually ready to wire within a few days. Chinese investors will take a different approach, where they'll agree to a high level term sheet, then they'll do some more diligence, and then finally get to a funding status. So the whole process takes about the same like the time, but it's a matter of when do you celebrate? And the only time to celebrate is once the deal is closed.
For global companies come to China, and if they want to looking for the fundraisings here from the China investors, So one question a lot of the China investor will ask is, what is your China angle? What is your plan in China? Because they know pretty much everything about China market, but they sometimes they barely know about the US market or the European market. If your plan is to, let's say, IPO in Europe, Switzerland or France, they don't even know about the capital market there. But the only thing they know is what's your plan in China. So if they can make profit or return on your China market, there's a good opportunity to get their fund. But if it solely depends on their overseas business, I think it'll be a little bit different, difficult. And also for some global funds, they do have, let's say, US office, China office, European office. So if you come to China office, they will mainly focus on the China. If it's not, there's no China angle, they will just refer to the European or the US office. It's not their responsibility to take over this case. So it's better to have a China angle. Whether you want to find a partner here in China, or you can find a partner with their investors portfolio company here in China, or if the CEO is Chinese, that would be even better, or at least there's some Chinese face in their company who have very deep insight about the China market.
Shelly, Tis, and Jian, would you like to add one final statement before we wrap it up?
Sure, I'll start. Yeah, so I mean, looking at the first quarter of 2022, 18 new drugs were approved in China. 12 of them came from the West. You know, China's a terrific market for innovation and to commercialize, the second largest in the world. I think it's really important for innovation to look to China for both investment, partnering, product approvals, and registration. And so I think it's an exciting time to be in biotech.
Just to add to that, if you believe in your innovation, if you believe that your technology innovation has a place in healthcare, you must consider China now or later, but it must be in your thinking. Otherwise, you are not forward thinking and you're doing a disservice to your company.
Yeah, I would say plan the China strategy as early as possible. Even though you may not want to do an immediate deal at this moment, but it's better to get some feedback from the China partners, potential partners. It will be beneficial for your future clinical development plan.
Jian, Shelly, this thank you very much for this amazing conversation. I learned a lot of new things about the go to China market strategy, and I hope we can catch up pretty soon.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Christian.
Have a great day. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Do you enjoy this episode? Then please like, follow, and share. Have a great day.